Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting and currently rainy El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we've talked about a lot of interesting topics. Routinely during the day, I kind of keep half an eye on that clown show in Washington. And today was just annoying. As a field-grade Army officer, lied his ass off and got applause from the ultra-left that thinks whatever you have to do to take down the president is admirable. Now, the a lot of very bizarre things have happened in this country. But the thing that just fries me no end is injustice. And this impeachment inquiry has been organized so that there's nothing the president can do to show his innocence. Somebody who doesn't believe in what this country is basically about. It's like I told some law enforcement officer the other day. If you don't want to enforce the law, turn in your gun, turn in your badge, and go do something else. You took an oath. Live up to that oath. Now that I've had my chance to vent a little bit, if you want to call in, the number is 267-521-0159. And this show is primarily about bizarre happenings. Now, there have been many who say that there is another world that we just can't see. And sometimes our world and that world overlap. And then when that happens, strange things occur. There was a clairvoyant by the name of Christopher Barber. And he is said to assist the police, helping to solve murders and find missing bodies. He lives in northern Arizona, which is wooded. And one day he went for a walk. He had a lot on his mind, and he wanted to get out and stretch his legs and, just kind of recharge his battery, so to speak. So he walked for almost an hour, considering the the problems he was wrestling with. And he suddenly realized he had left the path. And he's walking through a thicket of trees and woods and shrubs. And suddenly, he heard a woman's voice calling his name. You know, there's a certain manner that people who know you use when they call your name. And he knew he was by himself, so of course he stopped and he turned around. And there in the distance, he saw a very nice-looking woman. She had long, dark hair, wearing a gown. And then, almost as soon as it registered, she was gone. And he was utterly baffled. Well, he turned back to continue his walk and realized that just on the other side of those shrubs right in front of him was a gully with jagged rocks at the bottom. Had he taken that next step, which he would have had he not stopped, he would have been seriously injured, possibly killed. Now, there's a lot of stories that I've heard from folks who served in war zones. And one that I found very interesting, it came from the Korean War. It's 1950. A young man named Michael, he was a Marine. And he actually wrote a letter to his mother describing what happened, and he also told a number of other people, to include the unit chaplain, and they all vouched for what he said. And in fact, the letter was read to a gathering of 500 Marines at the Naval Base in San Diego. And according to what the one man said, he reminded his mother that she had told him to pray to St. Michael every day for protection. And he was a religious young man, and so he did that. And on one particular day, he and his unit sent out to scout for enemy soldiers in dense jungle terrain. Now, if you've never been in a war zone, you've never been in a jungle, you have no concept of what being on that in that terrain does to your senses. Someone can be 5 feet from you and you can't see them. Well, as he walked along, he suddenly realized there was a huge Marine walking alongside him. He said the man was massive. And he started to talk to him, and he expressed his surprise. He didn't know who this man was because he knew everybody in the unit. And the man said his name was Michael. And the young Marine expressed surprise and said, "But that's my name, too." And the stranger said, "I know," and started to recite the first line of the prayer that young Marine said every single morning. Now, the weather was bad. If you know anything about Korea, it's at certain times of the year has two seasons, cold and frigid. And it was snowing, which reduced visibility. And Michael suddenly realized, as he looked at the huge man walking beside him, while he could see his own breath, he couldn't see any breath coming out of the stranger. And he started to comment on it, but the stranger looked at him and said, "There's going to be trouble ahead." Suddenly, the snow cleared and they came face to face with a unit of enemy soldiers. Well, Michael dove for cover and shouted at the stranger to get down, but the big Marine just stood there. Bullets were flying at him. Excuse me, Michael jumped up to pull the man down to the ground, and at that point in time, he got hit. And he remembers being held by the stranger, his big strong arms holding it up before the stranger lowered him to the ground and stood up and He said there was a terrible splendor in that face. He seemed to grow. The splendor was intense, like wings, and in his hand he held a sword. We're talking 1950 Korea. M1 Garand. Maybe the BAR, Brown Automatic Rifle. If nothing else, 45s. But he sees a man wielding a sword. And then he passed out. Later in the hospital, the sergeant came to see him and said, "How did you kill all those North Korean soldiers?" And Michael was completely confused. Apparently, of his unit, he was the only one that survived. He said the sergeant went on to explain, "There were bodies strewn all around you, each and every one killed by a single sword stroke." Now, I don't remember you carrying a sword, but you had to have something to do with it because you were the only one of either side alive. What was that, St. Michael, who is known to carry a sword? Certainly that would explain a lot. And in the realm of the strange, invisible, and sudden manifestations, there also appears to be another phenomenon that at times is completely baffling. You know, the Highland Mountain Ranges in Scotland are wild, magnificent places. But many witnesses claim that the terrain can hold a dark side that's terrified many and quite possibly led to the deaths of others. Ben McDuey is the highest peak in the Cairngorms. Many mountaineers are certain that this region harbors an entity called Fearleath Mór. Translate that means the big gray man. Gray in color, huge, fearsome. Many people have encountered him. Legend tells of it stalking anyone who trespasses into its territory. And of course, in this day and time, we all laugh at those that believe in legends. But when Professor Norman Colley spoke at the AGM of the Cairngorm Climbing Club in 1925, he reported an incident that happened to him. Back in 1891, he said, after conquering the summit, he was in the process of coming down through the heavy mist and fog when he began to hear noises in the loose rock behind him. Every few steps he took, he'd hear a crunch behind him, and then another as if somebody's walking behind him. And they were taking heavy steps, many times the length of my own. Well, he continued to descend, telling himself he was just imagining everything, but the loud crunches behind him continued as well. And in that fog by himself, he started to become more and more unnerved. Something very big was coming fast behind him, and it wasn't long before he found himself seized by terror and running blindly down the mountainside amidst the fog until they got to the forest at the bottom and ran into the covering of trees. Finally, stopping to look back, he couldn't see anything, but he knew he was being stalked by some huge, menacing creature, and so he ran on. Desperate to get to safety. He told the climbers at the meeting that he had vowed he'd never return there alone again. He was convinced that there had been something deeply disturbing tracking him. Now, he wasn't able to catch any real sight of it, but he never forgot the sound of the crunching behind him as that huge creature stalked him. After hearing the professor's experience, other mountaineers at the meeting began to admit that they had also experienced some very strange things on that mountain. They told of rapidly developing sensations of uncontrollable fear, panic, and terror for no logical reason. Some even exclaimed they had felt irresistibly drawn toward a dangerous crevice or cliff as though in a trance and coming perilously close to going over the edge before somehow managing to snap out of it. Well, murmurs and rumors grew, speculating on how many climbers might have been chased to certain death by an entity or some malevolent force. Following his telling of that story at the meeting, Professor got a letter from a doctor who told of his own frightening experience on that same mountain. The doctor and his brother were on the deserted mountain near the summit when they suddenly saw a giant figure coming toward them. Terrified, they fled that instant, never having seen anything like it before, and terribly aware of how small and alone they were out on that mountain. One does have to wonder, though, how many climbers didn't see it coming and weren't lucky enough to be able to flee. There's a young lady named Wendy Wood, who was heavily involved in the foundings of the Scottish National Party. She's been described as one of the most rational people on the planet. But she was gripped by blind panic when walking through the Langroot Pass. She was hiking there alone when she suddenly heard a voice. Thinking it might have been a fallen climber, she went to see if she could help, but couldn't find anybody. She later described that voice as being extremely loud and close and sounding like it was spoken in the Gaelic dialect. Looking all around, she tried to see who it was that had spoken to her, but she couldn't find anybody. Well, spooked by the incident, she hurried to get away from the area, but she became overwhelmed by the feeling she was being followed by someone or something with an enormous stride. She could hear footsteps behind her as she went. Well, at first she tried to reason with herself that the footsteps were just echoes of her own, thinking the mountainous setting could cause an echo to occur, but then she realized to her horror the footsteps sounded wholly different from her own steps. So she ran as fast as she could. Then in February 2015, climber Chris Slide, a producer of BBC Scotland Outdoor Shows, spoke about a remarkable incident that occurred just a few days before. He was climbing the peak of Ben Nevis, the highest mountain in Scotland, with a close friend. He said, "When I climb, I listen hard. There's so many clues that will tell you what's going right or wrong, and sounds like comfort, like the thud of a pick in good ice, the clip snapping shut, holding the rope that'll hold you if you fall. And there are sounds that warn. And there are sounds you never want to hear. So when I heard a blood-curdling scream, I feared the absolute worst. Started out almost indistinct, muffled, but quickly became sharp, visceral, and piercing. I was hearing somebody who just watched a loved one fall to their death. And there was so much loss and pain in that sound, I wanted to be off that mountain, but I was hanging vertical off a wall. I froze. Sent my blood running cold and brought home consequences, but there was nowhere to go. He and his friend had no choice but to continue upward, which they judged to be the safest route. So they continued their climb and managed the safe descent. They both wondered why there wasn't more noise, more activity going on. What they expected to see was a rescue party, voices searching for the body and the screaming friend or partner. They knew something had happened. A fatality. A climber had fallen to their death, but no noise, no activity. Well, as they emerged from the misted mountaintop, they did their own search of the area, but they didn't find anybody. At the base of the mountain, they talked to other climbers, and they'd heard that piercing scream as well. One even went to investigate where he thought it was coming from, but he didn't find anybody there. And even more strangely, none of the climbers there could find any evidence of an accident having taken place. And when they contacted the police, no accident reports had been made. And there was no one missing. Well, he and his friend carried on trying to investigate over the remaining hours, and there was no news, no evidence showed up. The mountain rescue team came and searched, but they didn't find the sign of anybody either and eventually stopped looking. They said, "We don't know who it was screaming, and we don't know what happened that day, and we probably never will." Very human-sounding but wholly unearthly scream could send the most prepared but unsuspecting climber falling, losing their grip and making a terrible fatal mistake from the sudden shock of it, causing them to flounder and fall or unnerve someone so badly they stumble, get disoriented, and lose their bearings. Maybe they get lost and wander into treacherous, unforgiving territory. How many times could this have happened out alone in the wilderness? Having rappelled many, many times in my life, I know how easy you can lose your grip and fall if you're not careful. There was a hiker and blogger named S.S. Drim of Misguided Ghost wrote about a youthful encounter in the abandoned grounds of the West Mountain Sanitarium in Pennsylvania. He called it the scariest night of his life. Now, set atop West Mountain in what was once an old mining community, he decided to explore. There are people who love to explore deserted buildings and towns. He said a few friends and he took a trip to the sanitarium. They'd never been there before. They'd never imagined what would happen. As a friend was dropping them off there for the night, another car was there. As they walked inside past the gate, it seemed to be watching them. In the dark, they couldn't see who was inside it, so had no idea why they'd be watching. Slightly uneasy, they got off the main path and ducked behind a wall, and the car drove on toward the asylum. Well, he said they were somewhat unsettled by all this. They wanted to go to the building, but the car had gone up there. Well, the car returned in a few minutes and drove slowly past them as if it was looking for them. They decided they should get out of there, so they decided to stay off the road and go back down the hill through the woods. As they slowly made their way down through the darkness, they could hear somebody behind them walking. They were now being followed on foot. They continued down through the trees, but got down when they seen those footsteps seemed to be coming closer. They were all crouched down as their friend who dropped them there called, and when he answered the call, he asked them to get back there and get them. Well, the crunching got closer, and he noticed there wasn't any laughing or any talking among them. How could they maintain cold precision like that for so long? And he started to believe something really sinister was going on. And then it happened. As they hid there in the bushes, they heard the most horrifying, inhuman, blood-curdling scream. It was real. It was inhuman. It echoed into the night. Unable to even think straight, whatever it was happening to them was real, and they all took off down the hill and out onto the road. They were sprinting. They were running as hard as they could go. But by the time the group got back together again, they seemed to be past the worst of the ordeal. They decided later that whoever this was just wanted to mess with people, but there's still that small chance that something supernatural was going on. Because they all described that horrifying, blood-curdling scream as inhuman. Well, there are many locations I've been that shouldn't have gone. One thing I discovered early on, when you write a book and you tell people you're writing a new one, they let you go places you shouldn't be allowed to go and do things you never should be allowed to do. So, of course, you wind up in unusual situations. There was a young lady named Anna Evans. 15 or 20 years ago, she took to posting in internet forums that dealt with the paranormal and trying to find anyone else who'd had a similar experience to hers. She was trying to understand what had happened to her when she was 15. She was staying with her family, her mother, father, younger brother, and two younger sisters in a cottage they owned in an isolated and deserted valley close to the west coast of Donegal in Ireland. It was summer, and as the family finished lunch, Anna went out to the front doorstep to stand in the sunshine. Now, the cottage was remote, with no neighbors for miles. Nearest property was a 20-minute walk up a small trail, but the owner of that property had died, and no one had yet moved in. And there was no electricity or telephone lines. At the time it happened, it was a calm, warm afternoon. She was enjoying the rare sunshine. Suddenly she became aware of a sound. It sounded like voices calling her name in unison, and there were several of them. It was like low whispers as a collective, and it was continuous. She listened to it for a few minutes, attempting to gauge it for fear of making a fool of herself. Then she called her mother and asked if she could hear anything. Her mother agreed that she could hear something, and she said it was voices calling the girl's name. The whole family could hear it, including her father, who's a professor and a doctor, and a highly skeptical person by nature, but none of them could find the source. It could be heard at the same unwavering level outside and in every part of the house and every room. Even stood and looked up the chimney in an attempt to put it down to wind, but there was no wind blowing. Well, in desperation to explain it, she walked 500 yards up the hill by where she could still hear it. Persistent, incessant whispering, her brother was petrified with fear and got under his bedclothes with his hands over his ears. Well, after about half an hour, they became numb to it, and eventually the voices faded away. She's never again experienced anything like it, and no explanation has ever been found. There was no one within miles of them. There were only a few birds in the area, no machinery. The area itself is barren mountain and valley. So ask yourself, how many people might have experienced the same phenomenon? Out alone, the sound of voices calling your name, luring and enticing you to find them, to follow them in the wilderness to an unknown destination? How many disappearances can be put down to that? Now, there's an organization called the National UFO Reporting Center, NUFORC. It's run by Peter Davenport. And there was an odd incident regarding a public employee holding down a job with responsibilities for over 20 years. He said he was out deer hunting in Illinois in mid-afternoon in November of 2014. He was sitting in his deer stand when all of a sudden something that looked like a ball of shiny motor oil appeared from above him. It hovered about 4 feet away. He said it was a ball, no question about it. First, he thought it was an insect. He stared at it for a few seconds, realizing it wasn't an insect. Now, he's used to seeing insects and moths when hunting, but you've been below freezing for several days. You don't see insects in that particular weather. This ball thing hovered there in front of him at eye level, moving up and down, but not getting any closer. He said he grabbed hold of the seat of the stand and reached out with his other hand to try to grab the ball. Well, it avoided him, dropped to the level of his feet, and began to hover again. Well, he sat down and it came back up to eye level. He said it went up slowly. And it went up and down about a foot in front of him and hovered at eye level. Now, he didn't see this out of the corner of his eye. He looked at it close and clear the entire time. And before he could reach out and try to grab it again, it curved away, and as it blended with the leaves on the ground, he lost sight of it. Now, he had no idea what he'd just seen, and he tried to explain it away. The wind blowing toward him, it stayed the same distance the entire time, hovering, defying gravity. It was like a ball of shiny motor oil. It had no wings, legs, propellers, and it was not a stick or a leaf. Now, was it a biological entity? Or was it something mechanical? Some type of drone? I've seen drones that can do that, but they don't usually look like shiny motor oil. Well, there's been a theory that there are much more sophisticated drones out there than we've seen, as well as other advanced technological monitoring equipment, or weaponized technology, I guess you could say. Now, I've been told by folks in positions to know that any technology we see is at least two versions obsolete. For example, the stealth was flying over Rachel, Nevada for several years before we were ever made aware of it. And we use drones quite a bit in the military. And are there more sophisticated drones that we've been allowed to see? Is technology being used on us and against us without our knowledge or consent? And if it is, what's the purpose? Now, there's been a number of stories that make it appear that, in fact, there's a whole lot going on that we don't know about. There was a teenager named Jenna Jones who was found hanging from a tree in woods named locally as the Snake Pit. She was found by a man walking his dog. He said he was shaken to the core. It was so shocking to find this one girl. Why are young people doing this? I don't understand it at all. One of her best friends said to reporters who came to cover the story, "I can't get my head around it. She's completely fine when I was talking to her yesterday." And the mother of the dead girl's best friend said, "I saw her last night. She didn't have a care in the world. Always laughing and giggling. That's who she was." I can't understand what's going on around here. Now here, what she was referring to is a rural post-industrial area of Wales called Bridge End. Small town surrounded by woods and moorland and about an hour's drive from the Brecon Beacons National Park. Only a few months prior to this young girl's suicide, her teenage cousin Zach also was said to have hung himself. Now, this happened in 2008, and the girl at Snake Pit Woods was now the 17th suicide of teenagers in that same small area. It began with an 18-year-old named Dale who hung himself in 2007. His friend Di hung himself the next month. 2 days before the funeral, another friend hung himself in the woods. Di's stepfather spoke to the Times newspaper describing how inexplicable to him it was. He said his stepson was a naturally friendly boy, liked by everybody, with a lively nature and plans in place to train as a painter. So why'd he kill himself? That question was never answered. After an evening hanging around the local streets with his mates, he'd set off to walk home, and it was during that walk that something happened. Something that caused him to kill himself. 60 days later, a 21-year-old by the name of Lee got up from his laptop, went outside, and hung himself. Then a boy named Liam was found hanging in the woods one day after Boxing Day. And by the start of 2012, 79 young people hung themselves in these woods. Happy-go-lucky Sean Reeves hung himself from a tree on a hill. 26-year-old Neil was also found hanging in the woods. Kelly was found hanged hours after her cousin Nathan was declared dead by hanging. Natasha and Angie followed suit, and then Carwin was found hanging from a tree in the woods, followed by Anthony and then Elaine. The list of names just seemed to grow and grow, and every time it was suicide by hanging. Justin's mother couldn't understand what drove her son to do the same thing. They had a discussion. He walked out the front door and was found hung in the woods. She told reporters it could never be explained. He looked me in the eye and told me he'd never do that. And one evening we had a silly argument. He stormed upstairs, came back later, and threw a cord at me. He said it snapped, showing her that he just tried to hang himself. At this point, he called himself an ambulance at the hospital was assessed by the mental health nurse. Bizarrely, she sent him home. Despite telling her he had voices in his head telling him to do bad things, she sent him home. Well, shortly after his return home, despite his girlfriend being with him in his room, he left the house again, taking a belt with him. Family and police quickly searched the woods for him, but they were too late when they found him. He was dead. His mother said, "To this day, I have no idea why." A young woman named Michelle, who didn't live in that area, went there to visit her boyfriend and wound up hanging herself. Now, there were some others who weren't successful in their attempts to commit suicide. 15-year-old Leah has no recollection of having tried to hang herself, though others close to her know only too well that she did try. Now, what was highly unusual about all these suicides was not only was it this only happened in a so large a number in a relatively small rural area, they were also limited to a specific age range. And again, highly unusual, missing from practically all these suicides was any kind of suicide note. They just didn't leave any. It was like it was a spur-of-the-moment thing. Now, if you want to get involved in a discussion, you want to make your comments known, 267-521-0159. There was never any evidence of foul play in any of these deaths, and no indication at all to suggest these were murders. The evidence was clear. They were actually suicides, and all carried out in exactly the same way, using exactly the same method. Now, the Guardian newspaper consulted with a Dr. Johansson of Umeå University, whose specialist, specialization field is the study of teenage suicides. He said it's the largest cluster of teen suicides of modern time. It's a unique occurrence. Previously, nothing on this scale has ever been heard of. And the area in which it happened is one of high unemployment. It's not in a city. Job prospects are not good for teenagers or adults, so the result is higher poverty, less advancement, low motivation, and naturally a lower standard of living. And this is a very common problem in a lot of areas in both Wales and the United Kingdom, particularly in areas where coal mines and other industrial industries have declined. But young people hanging themselves hadn't become an epidemic in any other rural post-industrial areas apart from this one. Now, the first theory developed by the media was this was some kind of interlinked suicide pact, sort of a domino chain effect from emotional contagion, where each friend, so upset from the death of their friend, had followed the previous one to their death. And although they all occurred within a 15-mile radius, not all the victims knew each other. One of the girls who attempted was unsuccessful, told a Vanity Fair journalist, "I never knew the others, but my head kept telling me to do it because everything would be okay at that point." Well, while the local authorities and the police at first dismissed any connection between the suicides, they then went on to state that there was a strong link to social networking sites, given that all these young people had access to the same sites. And yet there was no evidence of any kind of collusion or encouragement toward each other. No taunting or egging each other on to kill themselves. And the coroner also followed the theory of the internet playing a major role, but the police couldn't find any clues online. No internet death pack, I guess you could say. Well, suicides among young people have become more common in school-aged children, where there's been some evidence of online bullying, but none was found in these cases, and never before had such a cluster of cases been found. The media, particularly the tabloids, then came under attack by the local authorities and police, accusing them of sensationalist reporting. And there were those in the local area who felt that by covering the growing number of teen suicides, it could somehow normalize the procedure, I guess you could say. In fact, they thought it might be encouraging people to kill themselves by having each case on the front page of their newspapers every day. Even suggested that there was a resulting media ban imposed on reporting the cases, but a lot of theories were bandied about. The only thing that became more clear than was that everybody, from those who lived locally to nationwide, are becoming more and more concerned and perplexed by the seemingly inexplicable and unceasing outbreak of suicides. And people wondered why they were all using the same method, when research suggests it's not the most common method, particularly for young women to use. Now, some of the victims were discovered during their inquest had been taking antidepressant medication. In 9 of the inquests, there was made mention of the fact that they were taking these drugs. Some were also found to have traces of drugs such as marijuana, but the coroner verdicts in these cases stated the amounts in their system was not high enough to give them suicidal ideation, as they called it. Independent of the coroners, Dr. David Healy, a psychiatrist, came out and stated the links here. Isn't the internet? Drugs like antidepressants and anti-anxiety can trigger suicide. Now, being an expert in the field, he's surely right about the suicidal side effect of the drugs. However, the millions around the world currently taken and the resulting suicides are nowhere near as high as that of the cluster in that rural Wales town. And probably aren't all by hanging. And again, only some of the suicide victims were taking them. But he added something else that everyone found startling. The hangings continue unabated, and the total number may be well above 90. They've been keeping a lot of the deaths quiet. Now, he wrote this in 2013, so in fact, it's probably much higher than it is now, than that now. And perhaps there really is a media blackout because the cases aren't being reported anymore. Coroners don't legally have to rule deaths as suicide unless it's very clear evidence that they are. Of course, it can be stated that a body hanging is clearly a suicide. But the coroners can rule these cases as misadventure, accidental, or just leave them open. They were all in their ruling on the clear evidence, he says, such as a suicide note, which we know in the Bridge End cases have not been found. The possibility then is that recurring suicides could now be being ruled as something else. In 2015, despite everyone thinking they suddenly seemed to stop, as though a switch had been turned off, one such critic of the lack of true figures is an investigative journalist named Derek Goh. In February of 2014, he said there's actually been 134, though the official figure is 79. He said there's no doubt a media blackout in place. He calls it a place wrapped in secrets. And some haven't stopped speculating as to what these secrets are. And there are a number of theories as to what was and could still be happening to cause these suicides. They believe something more sinister is going on. Fringe groups from the outset began to speculate that there was something far more malevolent happening. People kept asking, was something driving these young people to kill themselves, urging them on, telling them to do it? Were they somehow under the influence of something other than just hearing about the other suicides? Was something literally getting inside their heads? Well, there's a number of stories that came from some of these survivors after her unsuccessful suicide attempt. One young lady told Vanity Fair magazine, "My head kept telling me to do it because everything would be okay." And Justin, who was deemed fit enough to be discharged from the hospital, is having no mental illness despite having just tried to kill himself and telling the nursing staff he had voices in his head telling him to do bad things. Apparently, that wasn't considered serious enough to keep him under observation. They both claimed they were hearing voices telling them to kill themselves, but neither had a previous history of schizophrenia, which would be the only mental illness that would induce voices in their head. And it's not usually a sudden onset. And why did Leah, who also attempted to hang herself, say she didn't have any memory of it? Why could she not remember trying to take her own life? Had something temporarily happened to her to cause the episode? If it wasn't mental illness causing it, then where were these voices coming from? Indeed, one could even speculate that the sudden increase in young people there seeking sudden help from psychiatrists and being put on medication to control their newly manifested symptoms of anxiety and severe depression could possibly have been because of what they were hearing in their heads. So where were the voices coming from? Why did one of the deceased who lived in another part of the country and going to kill herself on a visit there to see her boyfriend? Was something happening in the geographical area to cause these voices to manifest? And again, because so few left suicide notes to show preparation of what they were intending to do was almost as though something inside of them suddenly snapped. Or worse, was it as if some were beginning to think more likely they were somehow targeted and triggered to kill themselves? The Daily Express newspaper featured the claims of a Dr. Roger Coghill, who said he'd discovered that all the young people live far closer than normal to a telecommunication mast. He claimed there was a strong circumstantial evidence that the mast could have triggered a depression. And we've had stories about that here in this country, that those who live near cell phone towers and microwave towers experience more illnesses and a lot of psychological problems. Now, the newer masks are higher power. It said in order to enable more data to be passed through from phones and laptops. But surely there were other areas in the UK where this was also the case. In much more built-up cities, an award-winning science writer, Ben Goldacre, refutes Coghill's claim, stating his data is highly flawed. Telecom companies are adamantly denying these claims. But many people still believe that the proximity to mast can cause them illnesses, and only time will tell if this is true. Others have pointed to Tetra as the possible cause. That's the police and government agency's new two-way radio communication system. Some police officers said to be reporting that it was making them sick due to its microwave pulsed frequency radiation. Implication here is not just that it was being used, however, but that perhaps its frequency was in some way being manipulated and directed at their young people. Not by the police, but through a subversive use of the Tetra towers. Well, there are those that say that these claims are just conspiracy theories. However, Dr. G. Hyland of Warwick University in the UK and an expert in physics and biology said, with low frequency pulsing, behavior and mood can be influenced from depression to rage, depending on the frequency modulation. And perhaps most crucially, he says it's actually possible to intracranially induce sounds and words. So you could actually put thoughts into people's heads. He was saying that words could be sent to somebody's head. They could hear words and sentences inside their heads that weren't their own and which no one else could hear. But again, this Tetra system is in use everywhere in the UK, so why manipulate it in just that one area unless that was a test? Well, there had to be more to this, something far more specific, but the speculation grew in the minds of conspiracy theorists that either the Tetra towers or telecommunication towers were being used in a nefarious way by government agencies as a way of transmitting microwaves to the head of this specific targeted group of young adults is an experiment in covert mind control and remote influencing. So the question becomes, is there any possibility that this could be true? Certainly far less harmful, but perhaps useful to serve as an example of technology that's been developed is the introduction of the mosquito device that has been used on UK streets. It's a form of remote influencing to influence and control behavior. It's been seen as an antisocial behavior sonic deterrent designed to repel troublemaking use from a particular area. The device emits a nasty sound wave that only young people can hear. Generally, it can only be heard by those under the age of 25. When installed in a rural town, Swindon in Wiltshire, the results were said to be effective with a decline in criminal damage and vandalism and fewer aggressive altercations in the area in which the sound was targeted. There's even pest control devices that use sonic waves. I've seen them in operation. They're quite effective. Some have said that a mosquito device was installed in Bridgend, but according to council planning records of April 2008, though the area was indeed discussed for a small underpass near a new housing estate, the council and police both advised against installation on the ground of potential infringement of human rights. So where were the masks being used? The edge former MI5 agent, physicist Barry Trower, claims he has firsthand knowledge of the sinister use of scalar waves, microwaves and Wi-Fi and masks. He claims that intelligence agencies misuse microwaves to negatively influence people, from triggering heart attacks to taking control of a person's mind by reading their thoughts and changing their thoughts. They can remotely control somebody without the person ever knowing it. and people can be programmed to kill or kill themselves, according to his claims. It's easy to make people hear voices in their skulls. This is not mental illness, he said. It's technology. His claim is that thousands of innocent people have been used as guinea pigs, and he believes the testing of psychotronic weapons has been extensively carried out. And then there's Tim Rifat, PhD, whose work is the study of mind control technology, and who quotes Dr. Ross Eady of Project Pandora, whose behavior modification experiments used low frequency on the exact frequency of the current system, such as Tetra use. And that all these experiments called frenzied emotional imbalance. And the U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force Scientific Board published a report back in 96 stating that from its studying of how the brain can be manipulated, it's possible to create speech in the human body for the possibility of covert suggestion. This was from Dr. John Hall, a specialist in this field. He has explained how subversive agencies can even directly access laptops and computers to remotely target the emotions of those using them. None of this is too far-fetched, he says. He cites Michael Persinger, expert in behavior neuroscience, as having once said he could quite confidently control every brain on the planet if he wanted to. Dr. Hall says that when somebody suddenly starts hearing a voice in their head telling them to do something to themselves, it can also be done by auto spotlight. A handheld device zoning in to focus only on you so that no one else around you can hear it, even though they're walking right beside you. Was there really some kind of human experimentation going on in this small rural town? Using technology on a specifically narrow target group to see if it's possible to cause self-destruction in mass, but only in a certain type of demographic. Was this some kind of sick test run or just overall imaginations? Then there were more claims, and this time they became even wilder in the form of somebody who claims they were an insider to MI6. James Casbolt, also known as Michael Prince, says that from an early age he was kept underground, first in Canada and taken to England, where he worked as, among other things, an assassin for the government, having been trained to kill people by remote influencing as well as physical means. About Bridge Inn, he said, I could be killed for this, but what's going on here is black ops. They're in that area searching for something. Well, that something, he later claimed, was an escaped reptilian shapeshifter that absconded from a nearby underground base below the Brecon beacons. Called a chimera, he claims it came for these young people and engaged with them, talking with them, telepathically hypnotizing them, and finally remote viewing them and feeding off their energies, they committed their terrible acts of self-destruction. I'm getting continual news stories that there is getting ready to be a Donnybrook in Congress among the Democratic impeachment pushers and the Republican representatives. Now, being near to one creates such intense feelings of depression and suicide as it lives to feed off the fear it generates in a person, he said. Reptilian chimeras, shapeshifters who walk among us and appear as men, many embedded in the population and many more in the military bases. A race progressed into technology without emotional development. Their mind is totally malevolent, or so he claims. These hangings, he says, are remote killings performed by these modified entities. He also says increasing amounts of children have gone missing in England and America. He said he'd been told that up to 1 million children have been given to the Greys. Now, there have been a number of stories. In fact, I got a book on missing persons coming out that discusses that in some detail. Should be noted this man is now on remand awaiting trial for an unrelated matter that if found guilty could see him sentenced for 10 years. Is he a fatidist? Hardly possible. And extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, or at the very least, some form of proof. And this is where the difficulty lies with most of the people who talk about these things. The tangible physical evidence just isn't there, kind of like the impeachment process. But he's not the first to have come out with claims as outlandish as this, and he probably won't be the last. What's most interesting here is that for those who've been following his interviews over the years, and I'd seen a few in the past, many feel there are times where he seems to have triggered himself. So he's an entirely different person with an altered personality in the more recent interviews than he is older ones. And some even claim his physiology seems changed or altered. But again, who really knows if he himself is some kind of genetically modified creation, as he claims, a mind-controlled victim, a disinformation artist, or just a complete fake. Regardless, it doesn't detract from more founded studies of the use of weaponized frequencies of microwaves and the more credible proponents, such as Dr. John Hall, supports this possibility. In seeking to explain the suicide cluster, perhaps worth mentioning that very nearby is an atmospheric place called Candleson Castle that sits among dunes and marshland. It's a 14th century ruin. It features heavily as a location in Kenneth Grant's books. Grant was a writer of the occult and a ceremonial magician who was once the personal secretary to Aleister Crowley. He was founder of the Thelemite organization on Crowley's death, appointed head of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. There's evidence that the ruins of occult rituals having taken place, and Grant was an accomplished practitioner. Did they release some malevolent entity from Candleston Castle? Well, Grant doesn't talk about this in his books, though we know, for example, that one time with Crowley at his summer cottage after a ritual summoning, they both believed they had managed to evoke Pan, the great elemental spirit. They said, "We saw Pan the satyr, an almost human countenance wreathed in a foliage amid bright light. A haze hung over the ground." Could something else have been released? Well, the problem when you get into these discussions, if you approach it from a practical standpoint, what we're talking about is absolutely impossible. But there have been enough impossible things that have happened that it raises the possibility there's more to existence than we know. For example, the Marine who met another Marine in his unit that he didn't know, who said his name was Michael. And all the dead North Koreans killed by a sword. Before he passed out, the Marine telling the story saw the other Marine, the Michael, carrying a sword. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night when once again we'll be talking about the strange and the unusual. This is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.